Hello and welcome to episode 162 of the Crate and Crowbar. It is the 18th of October 2016. My name is Chris Thurston and tonight I'm joined by Tom Senior.
Hello.
And Tom Francis.
Hello.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hello. News today, and probably the biggest news of the week, is the announcement, the long-awaited announcement, of Red Dead Redemption 2. Which we definitely now know is called Red Dead Redemption 2 and not any of the names that people have been guessing continuously
all week.
I was rooting for Red Dead Revengeance because I love it when people use that word.
Yeah, it seems like a strange, possibly the least interesting thing about this game is the title. But given that
all we have.
It was Red Dead Revolver and then Red Dead Redemption, yeah. It set a precedent for the R word, the second R word
it's,
being
it's
the
an
thing.
Opportunity. I think it's completely understandable, but I was hoping they'd do something.
Mm. Am I right in thinking that Red Dead Revolver was a bit different to Red Dead Redemption?
It was like a third person shooter, as far as I know, and pretty linear. And so, yeah, I mean, but still, the name I'd had knocking around for ages was Red Dead Rebellion. Mm. So I don't know if they changed that for some other reason or they were just going for the recognition, but yeah.
The only thing
they've revealed so far is that they, you know, they initially had this picture of the Rockstar logo on a red background and then a sunrise silhouetting some cowboys. And then finally the announcement that it wasn't like, you know, table tennis, but was in fact the cowboy game.
Yeah.
And so that is the only image now, which is seven grizzled cowboys marching out of the sunset, just because it is possible to pack as many Western, you know, cliches into one image as humanly possible. No one's ever done seven cowboys walking. That's never, you know, I mean, it's a magnificent idea, but it would never happen.
The timing seems interesting. I mean, I can't imagine they planned it around this, but like the Magnificent Seven remake just came out and then Westworld is new as well. And so there's all these Western things going on at the same time.
Do you think, you know, big media coordinates this? Like 2017, that's cowboys.
That's cowboy year.
Yeah. I don't know. So is the Westworld jumped the gun a bit. So we should caveat this, I guess, by saying that at the bottom of the announcement, only PS4 and Xbox One were listed. And given that Red Dead Redemption 1 never came to PC, there's obviously a danger that this might not.
Mm.
Pretty much all of their games, apart from Red Dead, came to PC, didn't they?
Yeah.
Apart from maybe table tennis. I can't remember.
Did Bully come to PC?
Bully did. Yeah.
Okay, Bully did.
Yeah.
And also, you know, we know that GTA Online made a ridiculous amount of money on PC, as did GTA generally. Mm. And they've announced Red Dead Online as a thing that comes alongside this, presumably equivalent to GTA Online. So it would seem kind of mad.
It would be astonishing if it didn't come to PC at some point.
But maybe it's going to be another case of like a year later
or
18 months later. So perhaps we're now talking about a game that we won't see on PC until
ages.
2018,
okay.
Which is the actual real future. But nonetheless, it is exciting. First Red Dead is a really great game.
Yeah, and this is the first open world that Rockstar will have built from the ground up on the new generation, you'd have thought. Obviously, they're straddling the generations with GTA 5, which is why they had different versions of that game. And you still don't know what they couldn't do because they had to make that world for PS3 and Xbox 360 at the same time. Whereas this, hopefully, they've been free to just exercise their maximum powers.
My completely impossible hope for it is that I'd love it to be quite short. Red Dead Redemption, I keep hearing how amazing it is. And I quite liked John Marsden. I particularly liked like a lot of the early dialogue was way better than Rockstar's usual stuff because it wasn't just assholes being assholes. But then increasingly as the game goes along, you are just working for assholes and you have to work for the assholes. And there's no real good explanation as to why you have to work for the assholes, but I've just got to help the CZ snake oil merchant who's a jerk to me all the time. And I just have to do favors for him. And I got sick of that. And I eventually just stopped playing. And I keep hearing I'm not sure how close I was to it, but like a latter bit is especially good.
Did you go to Mexico?
No.
Okay. So you were like most of the game away from the good.
Okay.
it has its peaks and troughs and it has a like, there are two amazing sequences, and then a spectacular lull. That when you go to Mexico, it's a genuine, like, this, when you head there, that sequence is incredible.
Hmm.
And then what you do there is rubbish, complete rubbish. And then the game picks up again when you finally return to the US for the final act.
Hmm.
And it is great and has a, you know, it's a rare example of a game that I think earns its ending and being incredibly long. Like, the ending of Red Dead Redemption wouldn't be as impactful had you not inhabited that world and hung around with that character for as long as you do. I think it really benefits from the slow burn thing of it all feeling a bit more weighty. Great use of music as well. Mm-hmm. Almost better because they can't just pack it with licensed music. They have to really pick their moments. Yeah.
Of course, that rides Mexico famously. Employing a certain, I don't know, kind of ruin it for people, which is weird because the game's really, really old. but it is, I think for PC players who, maybe it's easier to pick up a PS3 or something for super cheap and wonder whether they should just play Red Dead. Yeah, still worth playing, I think. It's really, it's their most mature game. It's,
still their best game.
It's probably their best game. Like in terms of shooting and just really just mechanical stuff, like, shooting people off horseback feels fucking amazing. The physics is great for those fights. The world is really extraordinarily evocative, and there's just so much love for the Western genre just built into it. It's a really, really wonderful game.
Yeah. Even tiny things like being able to, if you get really good at the quick draw duels, you can flick the gun in such a way to shoot the gun out of someone's hand, which is like the kind of the mercy way of doing it, but it's really fucking hard, which is the kind of the way it should be, I think, those kinds of honor point building systems. Yeah, it's great. And there's so much to it. You can sit and play poker in that game for ages.
Yeah.
And yeah, the thing that I think maybe, I don't know about the second game, like how exactly they're going to repeat the first game's success in terms of the narrative. I mean, maybe they can't. They could do all sorts of things with the systems and use, you know, modern technology to bring that world to life and give you more stuff to do and improve the gunplay and everything else. Mm. But I, as, you know, as derivative as the first game is of Westerns, it's arguably much less, you know, I mean, Rockstar games are always derivative of films. Like, they love movies and TV and they just pull from them freely when they build their games. And Red Dead is like that, but it's also quite, you know, a bit ambitious in terms of deconstructing the West a bit. And it's set really late. It's, you know, it starts in 1911, I think, or 1912. And the idea is these are the very last years of the old West and it's dying and mechanization is coming and the railway is coming and, you know, the sense of the frontier is fading. And it, you know, it uses that more for romantic effect than to like say anything, but it does, it feels like, you know, they're saying like, this is the last Western story that you can tell. This is about the last cowboys. So doing a sequel, which is about like, we found some more cowboys and we've, obviously it can't be really a sequel to Red Dead in chronological terms because that game concerns the death of the thing that game is about. So like, so it has to be back in, and from the blurb, it sounds like it's, you know, you're back in the thick of the old West.
Yeah. And showing a gang of people, like there's every possibility you're running a gang of outlaws perhaps, or, you know, that's a big part of the game. And it was interesting to see, trying to figure out whether the character at the front is in the middle is Marston, because Marston looks so generic anyway that as a silhouette, it's just
Overwatch.
Yeah. They've shown like a grainy outline of his face now. Yeah. And it still looks a bit like him. That's because he looks like a cross man with a beard and a cowboy hat.
Although they could do young Marston, I suppose. I mean, I'd like them to have just complete different characters and do a different pastiche.
It really wouldn't. I think if they do, because I mean, you know, like Red Dead 1 is about John Marston returning to the West. This is not a spoiler, having been sort of like co-opted by the FBI into hunting down members of his old gang. So you could tell a prequel, which is about that gang in its heyday.
Yeah.
Whatever. But the most interesting thing of that part of that story has been told substantially already. So you're not going to do anything more interesting with that story because you know how it ends if it's Marston. And, you know, I wouldn't be interested in finding out, oh, he decides to retire and go legit, but then he gets pulled back in later in a much more interesting story that I already know.
Like, yeah. For sure, for sure.
Maybe it is just seven protagonists in the way that GTA 5 had.
Shit.
The switch between them.
I think it's a missed opportunity that there isn't a single woman in that lineup of seven dudes either.
Yeah, it is a bit of a shame, isn't it? I mean, I would like to play their seven samurai kind of missions that would lead to. But yeah, it is a shame that, like, again.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know. At this point, it's become like a pointed thing now, hasn't it? Across between like GTA 5 and this and all of their previous characters, it's become a pointed just no women policy for their important characters in their games.
I mean, you know, the first Red Dead is notable for having some of the best female characters that Rockstar have ever written. Obviously, you can't play as any of them because it's a Rockstar game. But like, yeah, it was having those seven silhouettes and then one by one they all resolve into grizzled dudes. It felt nice. It's exciting though.
I mean, yeah, I'm really, really excited. Their open worlds are so, so good. That alone, even if, like, you kind of hate a lot of GTA 5 characters and story and stuff, but that city is fucking amazing. Mm. I've had so much fun with it online and just wandering around it and messing with it that, you know, that gives me so much hope.
Yeah. And I suppose the other thing is that regardless of whether or not they can do something more interesting, like in a genre sense with the Western, the good thing about Red Dead being a Western was that it stopped them from doing quite so much pastiche humor. Like there are funny bits in Red Dead, but there isn't as much. And there's no thing where it's like, we're going to send you to a thin veneer for Facebook.
Yeah,
and we're going to call it like face wank or something.
Yeah.
And it's going to be hilarious. Like they can't do that with the Western. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more serious, and that's weirdly refreshing. You'd say that games being self-serious would normally be the tired thing you're happy for them to get away with when they become a bit more irreverent. But actually in the case of Rockstar, prefer it.
Yeah.
They took it a bit more serious.
Yeah.
That's Red Dead 2. But there'll be more. So by the time this podcast comes out, there will be a trailer, apparently. So maybe half of the things that we've said will be wrong.
It's just all female characters. It's a total ruse.
Yeah.
The main character is a train. It's always to mechanize the West.
It's actually Railway Tycoon. Or like Zelda Spirit Tracks.
Yeah.
But with more like...
Industrialize this sector.
Yeah.
One track at a time.
That's not going to happen. It's going to be about a misunderstood man who has to kill a lot of people on the road to becoming not particularly well understood.
Mm.
What have you been playing, Tom? Actually, no. Tom Francis should tell us about where he's been. Mm. That's what should happen next.
I've been at Steam Dev Days in Seattle, and at the start they have a big. So it's a conference organized by Valve for developers, and it's only for developers, and it's not even for all developers because they, you sort of sign up to say you want to go, and then they kind of decide who goes by what logic, I don't know. And in the opening keynote, Greg Kuma explained that and said, you know, this is just for developers. One of the unique things about this conference is we don't allow press in here. And if you see anyone who is press, you should point at them and ask them to reconsider their life choices. And so I was sitting there sweating quietly as a former journalist. And now I'm going to tell you all about it. So they were right not to trust me. it's not actually secret because they put all the talks online eventually on YouTube. And the main one was like, the thing it reminded me of was basically like what Valve would do if they did a show at E3. You know, everyone's always saying they should do. And I suppose like there's no like game announcements really, but it's them evangelizing about their platform and their tech, particularly VR, and sort of showing graphs that show it's grown a lot, which actually like they're in a much better position to do than almost anyone else because they're actually like... their platform is one that's been around for a very long time and keeps growing massively. And it's the stats are kind of impressive. It was a very strange, the most concrete like announcement part of it, was a prototype of a new Vive controller, where the current ones are like big, thick wands with little circles on the end. And the new one is much smaller and kind of fits in the palm of your hand, but also straps to your hand. And the main feature of it is that you can let go of it and it stays in your hand, which is, there so that you can grab things in the virtual world by grabbing the controller in the real world. So to pick something up, you just reach out with your hand open and then clench your hand to pick it up, to grab it. And then, and so that's obviously more intuitive, but also it means that throwing gets way easier because the action you use to throw is now the same one you use in real life. You let go to release it. And I have found like Budget Cuts, which is probably one of the best VR games at the moment. Strongly involves throwing knives and it's extremely difficult and like I'm much, much worse at throwing things in that game than I am in real life. I'm not great in real life, but I like from 3 feet away, I could probably hit a robot in the head with a rock. I can't in Budget Cuts. I will miss like 5 times before I hit. And it's because you're holding a trigger and you've got to let go of a trigger at the right time. And I think I'm doing it when I would have let go of my fingers, but then letting go of your fingers is not a totally binary thing. And it's like something that probably my muscle memory takes into account amount of time it takes the fingers to release it or something.
It's like trying to throw something. It's like trying to throw an egg from the end of a spoon.
Yes. I think Budget Cut Sequel is actually going to be about that. Yeah, so I'm really excited about that. I didn't get a chance to try it, but it's only a very early prototype. I think it's going to be out for a while. But it also like made me realize something that I hadn't really thought about. Well, they showed an interesting slide where it was like a list of basically problems with the Vive, or like ways virtual reality could be improved. And one of them is like better resolution, and one of them is better response time, and one of them is better controllers, and another one is get rid of the tether. And the tether is like, that's the one I care about most. And they didn't have anything to announce on that front, but what they said was like, the advantage of this being an open platform is that there is a company, at least one company, for each one of those problems who thinks that is the biggest problem with VR, and they're actively working on solving it.
Huh.
And so I don't know if they're actually... Well, so they are like financially backing a company that is making a tetherless version, but it sounds to me like the sort of product that company is making is not something that Valve are going to like adopt as is, and or sort of just tell everyone to buy their product. I think it's probably going to be more like they're the early adopter version, and then Valve say, okay, now the technology's solved, we can make a really efficient version of that, and the Vive 2 will ship like that. But yeah, the thing that made me realize is that actually probably there won't be a Vive 2. I think it's going to be much more modular than that. I think the new controllers will ship, and then that will be, the controllers are now better. And then when they have a better, face display thingy, I think it's called an HMD, but I actually don't know what that stands for.
Head mounted display.
Okay. That'll probably be sold separately as well. So it'll be like a kind of modular thing where you just upgrade the bits of it as they get better.
Mm.
They're looking at the base stations as well, I think, was one of the other things they were talking about.
Oh, really?
Well, you're likely to know more than I am. But I thought I read that. Maybe not.
So they also, had part of that keynote was by Tim Sweeney of Epic, who is a big VR evangelist. Oh yeah, another thing Valve said was that they are all in on VR, so they're kind of doubling down on it, and stressing that the PC is kind of the, they still think the PC is the only place where VR is really interesting. Like, and Tim Sweeney gave a talk about kind of that, but also it was bizarre. It was part of the keynote, but it was quite rambling, and it was really just Tim Sweeney's vision of the metaverse, like what what the kind of Snow Crash style metaverse will be like once we all have VR. And it very much had the kind of like tone of a sort of Silicon Valley exec who's really, really hot in technology and understands it really well, but doesn't maybe understand society so well, and is racing ahead with like, oh, because we can do this with technology, we should. And the people will want this, but maybe the we should and people will want this parts were not as well considered as the, this is technologically possible.
In what way?
Just that, like, this idea that we'll all want to be in the same world and have like a coherent virtual space that we all walk around in. I don't know how interesting that is. He did, there's some quite interesting stuff he was talking about. Most of it is just like, this is possible, and also this is possible, and also this is possible. And so one of the things they're looking at is like, to be physically present in a, also to be represented in a virtual space, like multiplayer virtual reality environments. One of the key problems with them right now is that the other person is just a floating mask and two floating controllers. And so they're looking at like ways to like scan your face and have your facial expressions kind of, be projected onto an avatar. And they showed like a prototype of that being done in real time with like a super expensive, like mega rig, and an actress performing a pre-written scene, which is obviously like to some extent, staged, but all of her in-game avatar, which is like a super high res, sort of cinematic quality model, was animating based on the way her face is moving in real life with a bunch of sensors and stuff. And so it's basically saying that that's probably what we'll do eventually. And they've said that like, if you are sort of embodied in a virtual world and you have like, and you and your friend both join the same virtual world and you sit around talking, that is not very interesting. But if you add any kind of activity to it at all, then it gets way more interesting and you can spend hours in it. And, that works really well, apparently.
Huh.
But yeah, that was, Tim Sweeney's random thing. there's something slightly strange about it. Also, apparently John Carmack recently gave us a similar talk in which he said that mobile VR is the future and that's what everything should use.
I've just been watching the new Adam Curtis documentary, so it's like terrifying tie-in to creating a fake virtual world to control us. Tech utopians going crazy.
There was the stuff I did like in their both Valve and Tim Sweeney's talks were, they evangelize
a lot about it being an open platform and explained why that's a good thing. One of them is that lots of different companies can solve all the problems with it. But also they kind of want for this to be used more widely. They want the base stations to be kind of omnipresent, just like that be in public spaces and stuff. And, they want it to be compared it to Wi-Fi, basically. It should be a thing where, like, you know, in the same way that a cafe will provide Wi-Fi, they should also have these virtual reality sensors eventually. And so like the lighthouse station thing, they see that as like a really long-term thing. That'll be part of it, you know, for the foreseeable future, as far as they're concerned. And they are keen on their approach because the way the Vive works is that the lighthouse things are not actually sensors. They just project beams of stuff and everything else is the sensors. And that means that it's good for a public space because the lighthouses can't gather any information on you. There's no way to, like, right. There's no privacy concerns because they don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
All they do is just fill the room with the lasers and then your headset reads in where the lasers are.
Hmm.
Which, that specifically mentioning privacy concerns feels like a sort of like nod to their rival, which is Oculus, which is owned by Facebook.
Hmm. Yeah, we can't use this to track your every move down to the granular movements of your head now.
Yes.
Hmm.
Was there any talk about, you know, what the imagined applied vision for what virtual reality will be in the everyday life, like in 5 or 10 years time?
Only like individual things like that, you know, hanging out in a virtual space, talking to each other and having like sort of much less engaging games that you sort of play in that social way. There's already like, I can't remember what it's called, something pool. There's a virtual reality pool sim basically where you hang around and play pool. And apparently that's really good. Mm. And yeah, not much about like specifics of how it would work in daily life, just that they sort of suggested, indirectly said that it's, the final platform, which I don't think makes any sense at all. But, basically like once you're, you know, because this is total immersion, obviously this is completely immersive and has no drawbacks at all. that there's no need for any further like, kinds of input or interaction, which is obviously ridiculous. But yeah, they sort of talked about it as like a thing that would just be, there'll be something like this for a very long time and it will just be improved in various ways.
Yeah.
I do think that Tim is right and Epic are right, to be, really keen on virtual reality as a way of making games. Because they've already got it working with Unreal Editor, where you can just sort of make levels by picking up things and stretching them out and dragging them around, and that makes so much more sense than like fucking around little isometric displays and trying to find the right grab handle on a block to make it rotate instead of stretch. So that's cool.
You might as well use the grab handles we evolved. Was there anything non-VR related that came from what Valve had to say?
Not really. There was a lot of like, just talk about how on that's grown and stuff. And, they had a list of like what they're going to change about the storefront, but it was literally just a list of the things they've already changed about the storefront. It was, you know, discoverability and customizing things more to individual users and, you know, tweaking the way user reviews work. And it's like, okay. You just did all those things. If you're going to do something different to those things, we'd like to know about it, but they didn't have any details. So, you know, I'm sure they're probably working on the right things. Like I generally think they've sort of taken the store in a good direction. And they had some stats about like how, you know, 4 years ago or something, it was, there were like 11 games featured on the store page to everyone. All of Steam's customers, whereas these days there's like 600 different games being plugged into it depending on who you are and what else you've played and stuff like that. So more stuff is getting exposure. They also said that Steam is a meritocracy and that good stuff will rise to the top, which caused a lot of people to tweet various reactions to that.
Yeah. I agree, said the people whose games are visible at the front. I do not.
The point they were making was actually about Greenlight and how that, and, you know, the sort of rate at which they get games onto Steam now and how dramatic that's increased. You know, it's been an absolute, like, more than tenfold, I think, over the days when they were having to manually curate things. And they pointed to a bunch of games that basically they, I don't think they directly said it, but they sort of implied they probably would have rejected Stardew Valley and Undertale and a bunch of other games that went on to be super successful because they might not have seen the virtue of them. Like if you're a small team of people crunching through a whole load of games and you don't have a lot of chance to find the depth in them, then you'll judge by appearances a lot more. Whereas because they let everything in, those things did rise to the top and those were massively successful. So that's certainly true. There are loads of games on Steam that, became huge hits without any marketing, without any particular advantages going in. Of course, it doesn't mean that everything that's good gets successful. I think that's their, like, if they've raised their argument carefully, they can say something completely true, which is that, like, a lot of very good stuff can rise to the top purely by merit, and a lot of the stuff that rises to the top is good. And then going any further than that is probably a stretch.
You've been playing a VR thing, is that correct?
Yes, I've been playing Vanishing Realms, which is Zach Johnson, who's on the podcast recently, was persuading me to play it because he said that it's basically like a super generic fantasy RPG, but because it's in VR, everything's just 10 times better. Like, everything's way cooler than normal. It's first person, obviously, I guess it's... Yeah, that's still worth saying with VR, though. There are some non-first person VR games. And you are in like a castle type thing at first, and it is super, super generic. And you find these scrolls that tell you tutorial stuff, and you learn to pick things up and throw them around and stuff. And it basically comes down to like, you get a sword, and you get a bow, and you get a magic wand. I haven't got the magic wand yet, and I've played it for about an hour, I think. So it's quite slow in like introducing this stuff. And sword combat is garbage. bow combat is pretty good. And, I haven't got to the magic combat yet, but I imagine that's also going to be quite good. But yeah, it's got a very kind of like chunky, cartoony style. And so the first thing that struck me about it was like, you're in this very generic setting, as Zach said, and it's also not trying to be super realistic, but it was immediately kind of, exciting to be in this like really big, gloomy stone chamber, and to like creep, like, walk through it physically, and you still teleport around like you do in most of these games. And then I got to like the first little plinth with a bunch of with a tutorial scroll on it, and I think maybe like a key or something that I had to pick up. I picked that up, but I also picked up the torch that was lighting it, and waved it around and then threw it up in the air and caught it, and then just spent like 10 minutes throwing this torch up in the air and trying to catch it on the right end, because it's really good fun and it's quite difficult. And then like using the torch to like bat things off that plinth, knocking over the chalices and stuff, and it'll go clattering to the floor, and then setting fire to the tapestries behind it, which actually like light up and burn away. And so like just the same way as like when they first added physics to games, where you all just spent ages fucking around with the crates and stuff. With VR, you just spend ages fucking around with just picking things up and throwing them and, trying to catch them again. Then the first time you attack something with a sword, it's just really bad. Sword combat is just rubbish in VR, and I don't really know how it would get better either. Cause the thing you're swiping, they can't stop your hand moving in real life, right? So it's always going to go through stuff, and really, there's nothing they can do to stop you just waving your hand wildly in a way that would make your sword sort of hit someone 300 times a minute.
Yeah, waggling is a very legit sword fighting strategy in VR.
And they can't really do it by speed, because when you do that, you're actually moving it faster than you would if you did like a sort of a mighty swing or something. And so they have like, there's some kind of limiter where you have to move the sword a certain distance before it becomes damagey, but it doesn't really work. And enemies sort of clip through you as well. So like they get a little bit close to you and you get a little bit close to them. Suddenly you're sort of inside their model. Or you're certain your arm is like reaching right through them. And so I spend most of my time like waggling my sword wildly inside a big polygonal skeleton. And
I'll say,
and it's just sort of waiting for it to register the hits. Cause it successfully stops you from immediately killing things by doing that. But the way it does it is just sort of like, I think it doesn't let you hit them more than once a second or something. And a large number of my blows count as blocked, even though they didn't hit thing's shield. Just sort of like, it's holding a shield somewhere between this angle, and it's determined that my sword hit him at that angle, so therefore it's blocked, even though like physically I can see the sword is not touching the shield at all. So the rules don't really make sense. It doesn't feel good when you do hit them. It kind of makes like a sort of bang noise, but everything's really tough, so it takes like loads and loads of strikes, and then they block most of them. So it just takes a lot of time. And then like their threat to you, like, it is scary because all VR where anything can like attack you or get up close is just inherently scary. It's just like an instinctively horrible thing. So you really, really want to avoid damage, but like dodging in real life doesn't really work because they're so big that if you're in attacking range, then there is no, certainly in my room, I can't run far enough away to avoid a sword swing. So you basically have to teleport. And that feels really weird to like, it works really well that like you can just sort of point behind you and just tap the button to like teleport 7 feet away from this thing and then it can't hit you and then teleport back in to hit it again. But that's not really fun. It's weird. It's constantly, the only limit to how well you can do that is how well you can interact with the teleporting interface, which is not a very natural thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get a bow and shooting things with a bow is great. And, it's a surprisingly like difficult game. And a slow-paced one. I was expecting kind of more of a tech demo, so where they just give you all the toys and you play around with all the toys, but it's like really stingy. It doesn't even, you meet your first enemy with no sword at all, and I thought I might miss something because there's no, you can't like punch them as far as I know. Maybe you can. I think the puzzle there was just to like run away from it and then come back when you got a sword. And even when you find weapons, you have to buy them, and if you haven't collected enough coins by the time you reach them, then you don't get the weapon. You've got to go and scrounge for more coins and come back. And once you have a sword, the combat's relatively difficult. Once you have a bow, like before you get a bow, the enemies get bows, and so they're shooting at you from long range and you can't do anything about it. And then when you get a bow, you can shoot back at them, but now you're facing like three of them at once and they're all shooting at you. And dodging is less viable in this than it is in like Hollow Point, which is a game about dodging bullets. And so I ended up just teleporting to avoid them as well, which again felt kind of weird. But it is really fun to like shoot, you know, three different archers while they're all firing at you and you're kind of zapping around. I've found the wand, but I can't afford it because all of the pickups just cost money and it costs loads and loads of money. So I've got to go around and find some treasure chest beneath a mystical tree or something. I fought like a boss that was enormous and had a big chain mace, and it was trivially easy because I had a shield by that point. Shields are good. The things that work in VR are like guns, bows, and shields. Things that don't work in VR are swords. And it was really fun to like hold up my shield. Well, fun at first, but also incredibly exploitable to hold up my shield in whatever direction he's attacking. And I'm like inside him. My head is inside his belly at this point, and he's doing this huge charge up attack and swinging his mace in like a 10 meter radius, which I'm inside. And, that counts as being in his attack box or whatever. But as long as you're holding your shield to the left and his swing started on the left, then technically you blocked it. So it has nothing to do with like the physics of the situation. It's just like an arbitrary thing. And yeah, somewhere near him, I've got to find some kind of chest and then I'll be able to get some money to buy the wand and then I can tell you how magic works.
It sounds a lot like many of the same problems as Raw Data, which is the game, the cyberpunk wave survival first person action game that has like a laser katana and pistols, right, and stuff. And the katana in that, and you also teleport, and the katana in that has the issue of, yeah, when you're actually, if you are a certain distance away from someone and you take them down with one swipe, it feels amazing because everything about it feels right. Like even the fact that you go straight through them, it's like, well, yeah, I've got like a vibrating nano katana. Of course, yeah, it just like bisects this evil robot. That's fine. But as soon as you're close to somebody and you feel like you're more like you're whisking them, like it's much more of a sort of like wrist-based swivelly sort of like vibrating motion. That doesn't really
work. I wonder if you could make a sort of sci-fi weapon where the limitations you want to put on the player in terms of how you want them to swing would sort of make physical sense as well. Like a sort of, like a lightsaber that only extends, gradually as you swing it in one direction. So you have to swing for a decent amount of distance. And if you change direction, then it sort of retracts again. So you wouldn't get enough like range if you wobbled it back and forth.
Like a whip in some
ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was actually thinking about the chain mace that this boss had. Like that might be quite good in VR.
I have that. Yeah. It also strikes me that as part of this is possibly an AI problem, like or at least you could patch it up with AI that made sure it never got more than a certain distance from you. So even if you teleported on top of it, it would immediately get back a certain distance that is within your like reasonable arm's reach, but you don't end up with that awkward, I'm kind of like half inside this creature. It feels like these games are in a strange situation where you have to give the player the ability to teleport because that is how VR best functions without making you sick. But if you can teleport, then that is kind of what the game is about. Like, giving you swords and guns and bows or whatever is like cool, but like this is a game about a medieval person that can teleport, and Raw Data is a game about a cyberpunk person that can teleport. And in both cases, you're kind of Nightcrawler from the X-Men. And that's what the game becomes. That's what the primary skill becomes, because it's much better than anything else you can do. Hmm. Now, you can throw the katana at people and it, like a boomerang, which is rad and works really well. But it's also as good to teleport next to them and stab them.
Right.
I could imagine kind of gesture-based magic systems being really fucking cool in VR.
Yeah, I think that might be what Vanishing Realms has.
Yeah. I mean, I really want to play a game like Chaos, where you're a wizard who's stationary, and you're using gestures to summon monsters on a grid or something, and actually fighting against someone else who's actually...
Yeah, yeah, that'd be rad.
Yeah, I do kind of think that stuff where you don't move is almost more promising in VR, because teleporting... maybe we'll all just eventually get used to it, but it still doesn't totally work for me. It still feels very artificial and very like, I spend all my time just figuring out, am I allowed to teleport there? Can I, like, you know, you point your thing and it shows you on the ground. And a lot of the time it says, no, you can't teleport there. Like, in Vanishing Realms, you can't sort of teleport across a gap because it's not really teleportation. It's supposed to be you're walking there. And so if you couldn't walk there, you're not supposed to be able to teleport there. But then, you know, if you're at the edge of like a U-shaped bit of corridor, so there is a gap between you and there, you could walk around it. And does it let you do it there? Does it let you do it on top of that crate? Does it let you do it on the top of this other kind of crate? You spend a lot of time just finding out what you're allowed to do.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they talk about these are the only problems with VR, and once we've conquered this, we can do anything. But it actually seems like there are still some pretty significant base level issues of immersing people in any kind of world that isn't a cockpit. Or a wizard standing on a mountain. The two experiences that matter.
I've heard other things about like other methods of stopping sickness. And one says that like if you block out people's peripheral vision, then you can move them around, you know, with buttons and sticks and stuff without them getting sick. But I'm guessing, I haven't asked them, but I'm guessing that Valve don't consider that a sufficient, like it doesn't work well enough. It must still cause some nausea. Because that would be a better solution. Like that would feel less weird than teleporting, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if like any of those silly looking treadmill things will ever catch on sufficiently for this to, for that to be an option. But even then you probably would feel strange.
Yeah, I think the sickness is to do with like moving, you know, your view moving without your body knows that it didn't move in real life and probably
didn't move that far or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting one. Don't know how is this a game that's actually out, or is it an early access thing, or is it?
Can't remember if it's early access. It is. Yeah, it's publicly available.
Cool. Tom.
Yes.
What have you been playing?
I've been playing Thumper.
Lovely Thumper.
Thumper. A rhythm action game in which you play a tiny silvery scarab on a path into hell to kill a giant evil head called Crackhead. And on the way, you have to use your little silvery body to bop down on bass notes that are like little glowing rectangles that fly at you down this track. And you have to kind of hold down a button to plow through barriers that block your way.
I think we referred to it as the thump button last time we...
This is the thump button.
Yeah.
So you've got a thump button and hold down the thump button to go into kind of barrier crash mode. And there are also kind of turns where you have to turn your beetle a certain way to actually kind of surf around these bends that would otherwise kill you, or at least take off one of your two kind of lives. And it's very dark, ominous, basically very distressing game about holding you in a state of just clenched anxiety for long periods of time as you hurtle down this track. And it's kind of amazing, actually, like in terms of what it sets out to do and what it's trying to be. I think it's incredibly good.
I've heard that the level number is also the time signature for the tune that you're sort of like...
Yeah, apparently so. I have to kind of go back and check, because as you're playing it, you're in such a state of just... fuck this. Yeah, just, everything is just so tense that counting is hard. And you're just kind of doing there's a kind of call and response element to it. So as the bass notes and kind of hi-hat notes, barriers appear on the track ahead, you hear them appear. So they might go,
right.
And then you'd have to mimic that a second later as it comes down the track at you. So it's a lot about just kind of feeding back to the game where it's just feeding at you. Mm. But as that happens, there are actually lots of kind of interesting ways to score extra points. So when you hit a kind of thumper bass note, you can use that to launch upwards, and that will let you get higher barriers at a higher plane. And then if you're in that state and you thump down onto a bass note, you get like a mega thump that will give you extra points. And if you've got a big enough chain going, it sends a shockwave down the track that will create new bass notes and basically change the route. Your route is purely about vertical up and down and occasional reactive turning. But built within these kind of very, very linear tracks, there are loads of ways to score points and think really quickly and try and improve your score, which is what the game's really all about. So it's way, way smarter than it initially appears. And I'm really interested in unpacking it musically, because it's kind of not what I was expecting it to be. I was expecting it to have almost like drops and for you to be kind of making a soundtrack, making a big,
melodious. It's not.
No, it's not. It's not that at all. And in fact, it's kind of limited in the sense that all the noises you're hearing are very similar for the entire game, and all the views you're seeing are very similar for the whole game. The color palette it doesn't really vary that much. So it's quite a samey experience, but built within it, there's a lot of kind of interesting rhythmic complexity. And that's where they've decided to put all of their variation. But yeah, I really want to kind of just like literally score out one of their levels just to see what they're doing with their time signatures and stuff. Cause it puts you so on edge. And I think so much of it is actually about just wrong footing you all the time using rhythm and using your preconceptions of what rhythm should do in terms of even on level 4, which would be like a 4-4 level, which is the most comfortable place for people listening to Western pop music. Generally, that's the most comfortable time signature. Even on that, like, it's always awkward and always weird and just kind of, you're always just about to fuck it up in some way. And I think that a lot of it is they're creating these phrases that are maybe like 6.5 beats long, but mapped onto a 4-4 time signature that would just kind of fuck you up all the time and kind of subvert your expectations of where the downbeat should be and stuff. I think it's a much more intelligent game than it even appears, especially given that you are on this narrow track and your only interactions are to bop, hold bop or press bop and up, and then occasionally left and right.
Sometimes like side bop.
Occasionally side bop. And that's all it gives you. And out of this just small, pure system, it creates all this variety and interest. So I think it's a very clever game. It's not like a pleasurable game if you want to, you have to go in expecting a certain degree of, tolerance for long, repetitive, stressful sequences.
Which is interesting because like rhythm action is tremendous. It's either traditionally relaxing or empowering.
Right.
Like it's one of those two things. You're either like playing along with something like a pattern that unfolds in front of you and, you know, is the soothing meditative thing, or you're playing Guitar Hero or something and it's about the fantasy of enacting these kind of great empowering guitar solos or something. Whereas Thumper is neither of those things.
No, people might have dreamed about being a silvery beetle firing down a kind of chute into a giant crackhead's mouth, but it's not really the power fantasy that people traditionally think of. It gives you these occasional moments of satisfaction. So there are these kind of boss encounters that pop up halfway through each level and at the end, and something will kind of clamp its way, like a giant cosmic starfish will just kind of occupy the end of the track and start spitting out green notes at you. And you have to hit all of the green notes in order to unlock the mega green note. And when you hit that, it shoots a massive bolt of fire down the track into its face. And that is good. It's because it's violent. you've used rhythm to make a gun. So that's good. And you've shot the boss in the face, which is the most video game thing you can do. And that it does have those moments of satisfaction. The satisfaction mostly comes from surviving and then from score attack and kind of unlocking what the secret routes through the levels are. It's an interesting one because I wish it was a bit more melodically interesting, because it is a lot of ambient, like just, soft white noise that undulates in uncomfortable ways. And then occasionally you'll get a respite and it'll give you a chord or something, and that's your reward. Good job. Have this warm chord for 20 seconds before we send you back into hell. But I don't know. It depends what you're into, really.
I wonder what would happen if you sort of took a section of the game's score and then fed it into audio surf.
That's a good idea. How the games talk to each other. Yeah.
Mm.
That is a good idea, actually.
Yeah, it's very, like, I think when we talked about it last time I played it the first time, it's interesting that it's all sort of, not natural sounds, because obviously it's a very abstract landscape, but it's all metal on metal crashes and bangs, and feels like sort of, even though it's a rhythmic game, it's not even musically rhythmic. It's like a, like an accident put to a beat.
Yeah. And yeah, and it's weird because I'm fighting my own expectations going into it. So I was expecting the kind of bass and hi-hat notes to actually be kind of bass and hi-hat notes, instead of just like, boom, clack, 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 as you kind of crack through these barriers. And it's kind of weird that they have this analog sound when it's such a bizarre landscape anyway. Like, there's no reason why they couldn't make, like, or just something. And it actually, it does, like, proper, really old school house beats, like, that for like 3 or 4, 5 seconds, and you'll kind of carve out these beats, and then it'll immediately go back to something really uncomfortable and difficult. So it kind of gives you these moments of comfort and then takes it away from you again, which is cool, but ultimately stressful. And I'm still playing it. I'm desperate to get to the end of it and actually learn how to do it better. So there's definitely a draw to it. I think it's a game about challenge rather than a game about music, really, or anything else.
I don't think it's not about the music, though, because I think the fact that it's an uncomfortable sound is a big part of the experience. You know, like,
it's well made in that sense, in the sense that it does generate that. But it's quite one note. Not literally one note, but you know what I mean. I mean,
yeah.
It does this one thing, and it's going to do it to you for an hour.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of the best way of putting it, because it is a specific, like, and specific musical experience. Like, there is a... Its discomfort comes from its subversion of your expectations of what it's going to do next.
Which, like, is very intentional as well. Like, it's obviously, it's clearly, they know what they're doing with this stuff. And that, I admire that, but it doesn't make it like a pleasant place to be.
No.
But so if you're looking for a pleasant music game, it's not that. But if you like a really challenging game that is a rhythm action game that's unlike anything else, and it does look beautiful actually, has this tremendous sense of speed, then Thumper is pretty great. I admire it, I think.
I think I'm 4 or 5 worlds or whatever in now, and it's getting hard.
Yeah, that's when it starts to get really hard.
And it's hard, and it's that sort of game where you know you probably within 20 seconds of starting to play it, whether or not you're going to make any progress this session, whether your brain is in the right place or not. Because if you're not, it's not going to happen. Like,
and it is exhilarating later on. Like, the speed is extraordinary, and it sometimes just puts you into these tunnels where you can't even see what's coming, so you're just reacting so fast to the twists and turns and the notes that are suddenly there. And in those moments, it's probably at its best. It does get better towards the end, actually. So, like, level 7 and 8 are really good. Really, really enjoyed those. It's good. Chris, what have you been playing?
So, I've been playing Battlefield 1. Which became available for sort of pre-orders and stuff today. And obviously, we're talking about the multiplayer a bunch, so I want to talk about single player, because I started playing that. And actually, I'd seen like one of the trailers or something, but I didn't really know what to expect from it at all, because, I mean, Battlefield, the last couple of Battlefield games have had single player campaigns, and they've been like all right. And this one's super strange in a good way, but it's going to take a bit of unpacking, because, as we said before, like, World War One is an interesting choice for that game. And they're not shying away from that. The single player opens with, like, a black screen with some title cards on it. And I'm paraphrasing, but it basically says, these stories are based on a real war that happened 100 years ago in which 60 million people died. And that's like the first thing it tells you. This was the war that was supposed to end all war, and it ended nothing. And it's very serious. Like, from the first words you see on the screen, it's extremely, like, in your face about, like, this is one of the worst things that has ever happened to humanity. This was a civilization-wide loss of innocence that fundamentally changed the course of human history and how we relate to war, right? Like, it doesn't go quite that far, but this is second one. And to skip ahead a bit, hour and a half into the game, I'm fighting off a tank convoy in my big World War One tank as the Battlefield theme kicks in for the first time in the game, and it starts going like the dun 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 dun, and there's all these World War, and there's all these Jerrys coming in, and everyone's sort of screaming and going like, "Good shot, lad!" And you know, everyone's having a great time, and then it's war as hell again. And so it oscillates between those two things, but actually where it starts out, and so your first experience of it, and this actually happens when you first load the game, it's one of those, it just puts you straight into the tutorial, basically. And so I'm going to, you know, I will have to talk about a few things happen at the start. Not really spoilers, but like the way it does things. And where it starts out is a level of seriousness that I'm more likely to associate with like a walking simulator. And I appreciate the irony of saying, if you take a walking simulator and you add guns and shooting, what do you get? It has like, you wouldn't believe how maudlin it is. It is extremely serious. Like even by the standards of like, you know, war games. It starts out with like a flash cut of a soldier in bed in hospital, and a hand touches him and he wakes up and he's in like the trenches, and like a kind of burning hyper real version of the Somme, which is that everything in is bigger and louder and more impressive. And it's a, you know, like a young black soldier from, I think, the Harlem Hellfighters, which is a famous regiment. And then it says like flashes up like, you know, this is a fight against the odds. You're not expected to survive. And then you are fighting in this ruin and there's AI soldiers around and you fight for a bit and you can shoot people and all the systems are there. So you can pick up guns and swap guns with people and things like that from multiplayer. And people get closer and closer and closer and closer. And then the lower on health you get, time starts to slow down, which is a sort of an artistic thing. And so I was actually on the edge of death for quite a while, and I was just moving slowly, and everything's getting washed out and red, and you're like, and then I died, and it pulls out of you as you die, and the name of the person you were comes up on the screen with like, I've forgotten the guy's name, like someone, 1898 to 1918. And then it pulls out and goes down to a different part of the same map.
Oh, wow.
And you are someone else defending in like a building.
That's really cool.
And then you die again. And then it pulls out from them, puts you in a tank. And like, you're a gunner in a tank. And someone's like, the boys in the church are getting locked down. And then you do that. And the whole thing is this miserable, grey, bloody battlefield. And people are getting mowed down. You see like German soldiers scurry into holes and like hug themselves and hide. And you can just gun them down if you want. And most people are running away. Like it's a battle where most of the people you're shooting at, you're shooting them in the back because they're fleeing in different directions. And there's nothing kind of really heroic about it, apart from the scale that you see a Zeppelin crash in like a spectacular event. And there's lots of terrain destruction and stuff like that. Yeah. And it looks incredible. And then there's like a gas attack and you have to fight for a while with your gas mask on, which stops you from using iron sights. And you sort of learn about that. And all these things are mechanics for multiplayer. It's constantly drip feeding you like things that will be consistent features of the game. And you die and then, you know, again... And then the last time, it sort of cuts into a cutscene as you die. Or as the combat ends, you don't die. So you get hit by a shell and like knocked out. And then it like goes into a cutscene. And the cutscenes are all like pre-recorded videos. So there is an awkward like resolution shift. So it's not quite as seamless as it could be. And it's like, you're like a young American soldier facing like a young German soldier, and they both level their rifles at each other. And then they both like look like the tiredest and saddest they've ever been in their lives and just let the rifles like drop to the ground next to them. And then it sort of like zooms out and it's like, you know, this is, and there's a, I should say there's a voiceover over this entire thing about how awful this is, basically, how awful and unprecedented it is. And then it zooms out and you're in the world map and you can pick any one of five stories set in different parts of the world, and they are numbered, so there's a correct order. But each of these is then a mini campaign with different characters in different parts of the world, and it looks like each of these mini campaigns is about 2 hours long. So it's not, I've only done one of them. And so initially I think, oh, this is like a super linear kind of series of vignettes. That was my first impression of it. And, you know, deadly serious. The production values couldn't be higher, but it's so in your face that it almost feels like it's strange that this is attached to, it's the same thing we were talking about. It's strange that this is attached to such a kind of, it's so kind of like relentlessly, celebratory of war and conflict, even as it's telling you how awful everything is. And that dissonance isn't escapable. Like it's just in the DNA of that game to such an infirm degree. And then you get into the second bit, and the first sort of, if you go with number one, the first one is about a tank crew, like in 1918 in France. and the first section is driving a tank, and the sections maybe go on a little bit long, and the AI is not very good, but they are spectacular. You're driving a tank, and I was surprised by how much freedom of movement you have. You can pretty much chart your own course through the level. And a lot of that initial experience is about probably shaking off the assumptions you'd have made based on previous bad Battlefield games where they're super corridory. So knowing, oh, actually, I can go in a bit of a weird direction here or whatever. It's a lot of blowing up field guns and gunning people down and moving to the next objective and so on. And it does a lot of work to make you feel like, you know, we're all just regular boys in a terrible war. And it, which includes, you know, you see your, it does, like, when you first meet each main character, it does like a kind of like flashback, flash forward, flash middle kind of thing to place you in time. So you see the guy look at his hands and he's wearing driving gloves and he's a chauffeur sitting outside a mansion. And then he's like looking at his hands and they're covered in blood. But then he's looking at his hands just because why not? And he's in France.
Because he's bored.
And then he's like the driver and it's all like, you know, it's his first day driving a tank and, you know, he's just a regular old lad. And, you know, he used to be a chauffeur back home, but those days are gone. There's only war now. And everything's miserable, but also incredibly impressive. Like, they've done, you know, a huge job. The sound design is incredible. Like, it's the most impressive I've ever seen World War One depicted. Given that all the vehicles are less technologically advanced and smaller than their World War II equivalents would be, everything feels massive. Like, you see, there's a shot of, like, terrified British soldiers huddling in a trench at the start of this battle waiting for the tanks to go in, and then you see this massive tank like rear over the trench to like break down the barriers ahead of them and stuff like that, and it's all played up, and there's really no doubting like the skill that's gone into the staging of all this stuff. But yeah, so the first thing, like, you know, we're just regular guys and we're kind of scraping through and the tank barely works. But then the second sequence is you're escorting the tank through a forest at night in the mist, and you've got to go out and scout ahead, and as you get out your commander goes like, Edwards, don't go being a hero now. Just, you know, clear out the, you know, obstacles ahead. And when he says obstacles ahead, he means during a series of open outpost-based Far Cry-style stealth sections, kill single-handedly entire camps worth of Germans using a range of guns, melee combat, and silenced weapons. And so, and like, and as you get to the, and then, you know, there's lots of nice touches. Like, if the, when you start, you do these stealth sequences where there's, you know, guards on patrol and they have like awareness bars that fill up as you sneak up on them, and freeform, when a fight breaks out, the tank will come in to help but can take damage, and that's your kind of fail criteria. And then at the end of each one, your commander will pop out the top of the tank and either tell you to repair the tank if it's taking damage or just go like, wow, great job, glad you're on our side, magic man. just single-handedly. And this culminates in, towards the end of the sequence, where a sequence where you have to retrieve, it's really contrived, you have to retrieve 4 spark plugs that are located in 4 different places in a massive village. And it's completely open and freeform. You can go in the buildings, you can, it's, you know, it's heavily inspired by Far Cry. That's so you have binoculars that tag people. There are alarms that guards will run to that will summon APCs with more guards in them. It's the best, like, Battlefield single player has been since Bad Company in a, you know, Bad Company 2.
Yeah.
In, to a huge degree, like, I can't remember any of the recent ones having something quite as like systems driven. And then even when you're in vehicle combat and you're in the tank and you're fighting other tanks, you know, they've borrowed things like shooting them in the sides and the back to blow the tracks off to disable them and stuff like that. And like, it was interesting because over the course from doing that that prologue to finishing the first bit, basically when the first chapter ends with them triumphantly kicking into their World War One version of the Battlefield theme, which I'd forgotten was a thing. Like, I know it's in all of the games, but you know, they hadn't like done the full like fucking war, it's great, dun 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 dun, dun stuff. Like, it was almost like the, you know, horrifying World War One experiential documentary experience that they started out with sort of like melted away to reveal like a game about how awesome shooting people with a carbine is, which is super strange. And then I left that, and I was provided code by EA. I should clarify for some writing I'm going to do about it. And the particular version they gave me came with 5 battle packs or something like that. And I got a gold filigreed rifle. out of the box, which you, is revealed in a cutscene where like an angelic chorus goes like, oh my God. As a man takes a crowbar to a big World War One crate and it bursts open in a golden shower. Kind of golden shower. And like a fucking Sten gun or something with like golden paisley imprint flew out of it. And I'm like, wow, I'm sure going to take this to the battlefield of El Alamein. Like, whatever. It's real, just... Yeah, it's
sounds really
extraordinary. Like,
it sounds really entertaining though.
Yeah. There's a sequence during one of the tank bits, like the finale of the escorting the tank bit, where you have to like defend this like extended ridge line series of trenches and bunkers from like a German onslaught, lots of armored cars coming in and tanks and stuff. And like, I'd only been playing the game for an hour and a half and it had started by desperately trying to make me invest in like the reality of the horror of the front. And then it tries to make me invest in this new character as just a regular guy on his first day on the job. And he looks sort of really unassuming and a bit sad about everything. Mm. And I'm leaping off the top of a bunker, throwing a dynamite stick in front of a moving tank, running, sprinting, going prone again behind an obstacle, detonating the dynamite, then spinning around and deploying a huge anti-tank rifle and then one-shotting a guy on top of an armored carrier, which causes the entire thing to explode in the biggest explosion you've ever seen. And it's like, you know, it's interesting that the game tries to have both of those things and basically succeeds, but yeah, like, yeah. So, because ultimately it's like, it would be more fun if you were like, obviously it's hell and you know, there's the loss of life is devastating. But if you were there yourself, you'd want to be the magic man that can do anything.
Yeah.
I feel like to avoid this tonal dissonance, they should, right at the start of the game, just ask you, do you think war is sad or fun? And you choose one of those. It's just like a filter they layer over everything.
They even do
it. Be ultra maudlin or super.
I mean, immediately after the kind of like the battlefield theme moment where it all kicks off, it's a huge battle. You know, there's a final cutscene and stuff happens. And then it goes back to the titles to tell you like more than 300 tanks took part in this battle in real life. So many people died. So many of them. Anyway, here's the stats screen. Achievement. Like, it's, yeah, I mean, people may be in danger of banging on about dissonance a little bit too much. But it is kind of, it's also deliberate. It doesn't feel like, it feels like someone has made this thing, made both of these things at once and just not seen the slight irreconcilable discrepancies between the
imagine
two.
Imagine they knew it was already there, but it's kind of unsolvable. You either give people just a game about misery that is just miserable and is all about just how horrible that shit was. Or you kind of do the big frivolous thing and never ever acknowledge it, which is also kind of bad, really. Like maybe just you've got to nod at it in some way. So it feels like you can tread that line between absurdity and very maudlin.
I did forget to say that during midway through the sequence, you do control a pigeon.
Ah.
Is the pigeon sad or happy about war?
The pigeon is actually sort of serene. So it does.
Oh, I see.
So I appreciate I am telling you things that happen in the first hour or 2 hours of this game, but.
Yeah.
You know, basically the tank's in danger and you got to send the pigeon to get help.
awesome.
And like one of the members of the crew, and it's all mo-capped and voice acted, and there's like four guys in the tank and there's, you know, relationships that are developing. One of the guys is very angry and sad about the pigeon thing. He's like, don't release the pigeon. And the other guy, the commander's bellowing, you release the pigeon, release the pigeon or we'll all die. And he released the pigeon. And then it cuts to a bit where you just control the pigeon over the battlefield and the music kind of picks up and it's all kind of light and airy, but below you it's hell.
I see.
And you are a pigeon above it all because you don't understand because you're a pigeon. And you fly the pigeon and you have to basically like gently steer the pigeon through some rings of light, which represent the pigeon's internal sense of how to go home. And it's a beautiful white pigeon.
Perfect. Good. Okay. Exactly.
It's like pilot wings. And then the pigeon returns home, but the pigeon has a message, and the message says to shell the location where the tank is stuck, to scupper the tank, because obviously the Germans can't get their hands on it.
Right, yeah.
And so, and then it cuts to like a cinematic view of the shell, like piercing the clouds and then coming down, and everyone in the tank gets ready to die, but then they don't die. And it's
does the pigeon fly under the shell and just kind of sacrifice itself?
It doesn't. It's not clear what happens to the pigeon subsequently. The pigeon's ongoing. Maybe the pigeon will show up in every single. Maybe the pigeon is like the linking device between
all the narrator
or the final boss.
Yeah, exactly. God damn it, war pigeon! You actually killed Franz Ferdinand.
He's not tough. It's just really far away.
But yeah, like I think there's a solution to this, and I know I bang on about Battlefield Bad Company 2 being great, but one of the reasons it was great is because it was happy to be like an 80s action movie romp.
Mm.
Like with
jokes.
Very hard
to do that with World War One, isn't it?
I don't think it is.
Yeah.
I think we've established with pop culture that you can turn any conflict into a comedy or into a matinee adventure or into a farce.
Mm.
Or into tragedy. Like one of the five stories in this, one of the ones I haven't played, has you accompanying Lawrence of Arabia, right? Like it's embedded in pop culture as much as it's embedded in history and, you know, particularly in those depictions of like the Middle East. And so I don't know why there isn't a universe where this couldn't have been like action Blackadder.
Yeah.
You know, like you can spin, or maybe not. I mean, I think obviously Blackadder itself had a particular, you know, it's a black comedy about how horrible that war was. But I do sometimes think that levity or comedy is sometimes a more immature emotional response to a situation like this. Not making fun of the tragedy, not making fun of the people who died, but using levity to hold it in suspense for a bit, sort of, you know, elevate the humanity of certain parts of it. And maybe avoid that kind of maudlin excess mixed with comedy explosions. And, you know, I don't know. There's, it feels like, you know, as inspirations go, like the A-Team has gone out of favor as a kind of touchstone for what four men on a war adventure should look like in a video game. Whereas that's very much like where Bad Company 2 gets its tone from and the characterization of each person in the squad. Whereas like now everything, Call of Duty, Battlefield, it's always like, this is literally the worst and most awesome thing that has ever happened. I don't know. Super, like, I do want to play more of it. Like, the next one is about planes, and I want to see where that goes. And the investment is extraordinary.
Do you have to play them in order?
No. Mm-hmm. So you can play them in any order. I don't know if they escalate in difficulty in different ways, or each of them is, like, dedicated to teaching you a different part of the game, which it seems like it might be. But yeah, like, there's loads of cool stuff in it. Like, I just stress the AI isn't very good. So that means that, like, it's not as good a shooter as it could be.
Yeah.
Were they better? It's just way better than games of this particular type normally are.
Yeah.
So that's something. Like, you know, you could, you know, Far Cry or Wolfenstein are way better at doing the things that this game does.
Mm.
But the fact that it is trying, I don't know how much it deserves points for trying, but it is trying.
Encouraging though, isn't it?
Yeah. And I would say, I'm not just saying this because of my particular tastes, but I do think it's a shame they didn't invest this heavily in Battlefront. Actually, this format of like little vignettes taking place in different parts of a conflict seems like it would have been a way more fun fit for Star Wars than it is for World War One, because you don't have any of these problems with that. Like, I mean, that's the thing, Titanfall's out soon. I'm actually really looking forward to Titanfall.
Yeah.
Because I love a lot of this stuff. I love the spectacle of a AAA shooter with, I'm even looking forward to the new Call of Duty because it's set in space. And jokes aside, like, I don't have these thoughts when it's, I'm helping a big robot fight the robo war in space. Yeah. Like, it only occurs to me when the game is both trying to teach me a lesson about history and also encourage me to like fucking learn to bayonet charge, and so it can show me more of the cool melee takedown animations.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? It's 80% war is hell, 20% stealth takedown this man with the spade. You know?
Yeah. I want to play it though.
You should.
Sounds great.
You should. Yeah. Sounds like really first exciting. Battlefield campaign I'll play sometime. Yeah.
You definitely dip into it. I mean, by all accounts, like, the multiplayer is really good, so that's a good reason.
Yeah.
Sure. To the extent the single player is a bonus, then, you know.
There are so many shooters coming out all of a sudden that I actually care about for the first time in ages. Years.
This made me realize that we're in AAA season now. Like, you know, this is what money looks like when you pour it into a video game. I mean, it's worth saying again, like, the sound effects and the explosions and the environmental damage are extraordinary. Like, I got new headphones today and it sounds fucking
Dice of the Masters.
Yeah. It's like, they really are good at making that stuff you feel it, like the recoil of each weapon, the detonation of a shell in soil is something that you kind of feel through your eardrums. And that's, you know, a big part of the experience. I just don't know how to quite reconcile the tone of it with entertainment. I think that's ultimately the thing. But like the bit where the Battlefield theme kicked in was really exciting and really good. It was just that it came immediately, like an hour after it had been telling me how terrible this was and how much I should respect how awful everything is.
Mm. I really like the idea of every time you die, you switch to a new person. And each one being a little vignette. I wonder how much, presumably like when you die, it's sometimes your fault. And so you could have carried on. So by dying, you're sort of missing out on some chunk of it. So I wonder how long those things.
That only happens in the prologue.
Yeah. But I mean, for that,
I think one time I died, it felt like it just sort of killed me with a shell. Like I suspect I was doing okay. Cause then, I mean, it didn't feel off that I had this like whistle and then suddenly there was an explosion. I died. That felt, you know, that's probably. Not off.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, if you did want to make a whole game like that, how would you do it? To, like, you don't want to have, if they're really long, and I can imagine, like, someone playing through it in, like, the natural way and just dying when they died, and they were each time they move on, and they see a little bit of each thing, and then going through and replaying it and saying, I wonder how much more of that life I could have seen if I dodged that bullet and got past this bit. And then whether you, if you're going to make a game like that, would you eventually force kill them? Or would you have, like, each story have a possible happy ending?
Then you went to live on a farm.
Everyone in this war lived. You played as them all personally.
Yeah. It even does the sort of zoom out, tell you when your birthday is thing. When you die in the regular campaign, but then it puts you back to a checkpoint.
Right. You died this year. No, you didn't actually.
The checkpointing is a little bit weird. I can tell why it is this way, but like there are points where it checkpoints you can't save anywhere. But then if you, it only happens to be once, but if you die and go back to a checkpoint, it feels more like, how to explain? It feels more like there is a world state associated with that each checkpoint that it puts you in. That might not be exactly the same as the world state when you did the thing that triggered the checkpoint.
Yeah, right.
So in the bit with the village with four objectives, doing each objective triggers a save. But I did the first one having like fucked up and set off an alarm and, you know, put the village into an alert state. Then I died. And then when I loaded, the first objective had been done, but I was slightly further away than I was when I did it. And the alert state never happened. So it lets you do the stealth again. And that was, and then afterwards I got all the way to the end and did it. The epitome of that was, you know, my poor beleaguered tank driver riding a horse through a village to hunt down the last remaining German with a saber. But that feels like, it's not necessarily a game breaking thing because it just keeps you moving through it and allows you to probably just play through it and complete it without worrying about it too much. But if you're invested in those kinds of like open ended stealth challenges and you probably like the idea of quick saving and trying something a few different ways and the simulation isn't consistent in that way, like it will just put you back and you just do it again. It feels very, you know, it's a 7 out of 10 realization of the same systems that Far Cry or Deus Ex would use, But yeah.
Should we do questions?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Good. We're on accord. Oh, it's a tired Tuesday in the Creighton Crowbar. Thomas writes, inventory and crafting systems almost universally suck. Where have they been done well and what would you like to see? Or what would you like to see?
So I remember Marsh saying that the forest, he liked the crafting in that because you could see the ingredients in the final product. So if you make something out of 3 logs and a flint, the final product looks like 3 of those 3 logs and a flint. I don't know what that is. That's like a weaponized campfire. I like things where it's like, what I always want from games is the ability to combine things to produce unexpected results, like a set of consistent rules where I can combine anything with anything and the result will have some kind of like, benefit that's logical, but the system is complex enough that I can come up with something that the designer maybe didn't intend. So crafting systems almost never fulfill that because they're almost all recipe based. The designer comes up with all the recipes that work and nothing else works. So I like stuff like, actually, you know, I did enjoy the Heradric Cube in Diablo 2, where you'd put items in this thing and press a button and most of the time it would do nothing, but, this was recipe based, but, there were certain recipes that would, have useful effects. Some of them are a bit boring, like you just turn lower quality gems into better quality gems, which is useful but not that interesting. But you could combine like three standard magical weapons and it would make one weapon of a better quality, I think. I think the main thing I liked about that was it was pre-wiki days, and so it was mysterious. Like, I didn't know how this thing worked. I would just keep trying, putting things in it and pressing the button. And so when anything did work, it was like, whoa, look at that. But yeah, I think in general, I want something more systemic where it's just all rules like this. This item, when combined with anything else, gives it plus 10 damage, or this item, when combined with anything else, inverts its effect. And then you could come up with your own ideas for like how to mix those things together.
Yeah, crafting systems feel as though these days they're foisted on a load of games that just don't need them, for which it's just total busy work to have to combine three things into one slightly better thing. And, I mean, Far Cry is such a great example of this, an obvious example of this perhaps, but... Oh my god, three raccoon skins to hold a little bit more ammo. Like, it's just pure.
For a particular type of gun as well.
Yeah. It's such a pointless thing.
You have to kill a legendary shark to get the wallet that can fit more than $10,000, I think.
I think there's an element of that system that's cool. Like, the idea of having to kill a legendary shark and hunt it down. I just don't want to have to do it to have a bigger bag.
Yeah.
You know, that's really boring.
I can see that it was successful in getting me to hunt things. Like, I probably wouldn't have hunted things if they didn't give me a really strong mechanical need to do that. And
it's like a mechanical annoyance, though. I mean,
yeah, it is. And it is annoying, and so I'm strongly motivated to solve that annoyance. And so it works, and it pushed me to do what they wanted to push me to do. But you're right that, like, doing that by annoying me with limitations that are just kind of inconvenient is not a great motivator. Well, it is an effective motivator, but it's not a nice way to treat the players.
I think I look for physical verisimilitude, because if a game has an inventory system, then it's simulating the act of probably being a person who carries stuff and uses them for things to some degree, which is a very human experience that everyone relates to. But the actual act of carrying and using equipment in games is often so abstract that it bears no resemblance to how that actually works in real life. Down to just the act of acquiring stuff constantly is just not how people work. You don't walk into the kitchen and like, I should probably put every fork I own in this bag just in case. Like, and so I think I would like an inventory system that was, you know, focused on the physical nature of the things you're holding for one thing, but also on the fact that you don't hold that much stuff at any given time. You know, like if you go camping with a bag with some particular piece of equipment and that's all you use.
So I'm trying to approach this with heat sinkers at the moment. And I want to definitely want to avoid stockpiling. I don't want to let you, you know, if you can take all the grenades and they all stack into one pile, then, you will store them and probably not want to use them and keep on storing them more and more and more. And then both, you know, the game becomes potentially too easy if you do use them. And also you have less fun because you don't use those things because you want to preserve them. Like Deus Ex has this problem in spades. You hoard and hoard and hoard. And even when you've got like so many multi-tools that they don't fit in one stack anymore and you've got to start a new stack, I still don't really use them. And I had it with biocells on the latest Deus Ex. I got to the point where, like, you know, if I wanted to use those biocells, I could just use all my orgs forever, unlimitedly, because they're giving me so much power. And for most of the game, I had less fun because I wasn't using my orgs because I wanted to preserve this energy because it's a persistent resource. So I'm not, right now, I'm not going to let you stack anything in heat signature. You just have 8 slots. And, if you've got 2 grenades, they take up 2 slots. And, doesn't matter whether they're the same type or different types. And so I want to encourage you to kind of treat it more like a loadout. Like, here's the things I want to use in combat, and here's the things I'm going to combine, and I'm going to have to decide which of these things are most important to me. But then when you find stuff lying around, I can't really stop you from like dropping your things in your ship and then going into the other ship and picking up the things and then walking back there and dropping them there. I think I'm just going to let you sell stuff on the spot. So if you find some stuff that's on the ground and the only reason you want it is to sell it, then you can just sell it right now. It just like teleports to a shop somewhere. And you just get the money. And so that hopefully will solve like the carting things to sell them problem. But I still haven't really figured out a way to like stop the player. If the reason they want to stockpile that stuff is so that they can use it later, then I can't think of like a coherent way to stop you from doing that. I can strongly discourage it. I can make it a total pain in the ass and not really worth it. But there'll still be a kind of player who's like, well, technically the stuff is sort of valuable, so I'm going to manually walk each part of it back to my ship so I can drop it in my ship and then.
Destiny has a good solution for this with its, it kind of banks all, a lot of the, in, all the guns you collect, all the important exotic guns that you collect. And then you could go to a kiosk and pay to have them nano recreated in a way.
Cause they're like templates or something.
Yeah. So it's just like a kind of digital template of reality, the reality of the gun. It's just beam, just 3D prints it for you using, you know, space magic. And that has been, I think it's a really good system because it's not only, it satisfies the collection instinct because you can look at that collection anytime. You can go and say, oh, I got all the year one guns, but anytime you can just pull one out of that vault and take it in with you.
Can you, I guess this is guns. So like you don't really stockpile those anyway, right?
That's true.
There's no point in having more than one of the same kind.
Destiny handles grenades on cooldowns, so
right,
they're just magical grenades, really, and they just kind of respawn. And you can use your gear to improve all the various speeds of respawn for grenades and melee and stuff like that.
The other game that I think maybe does have a good inventory system, despite being a grid simple grid system, is DayZ. And the reason for that is that obviously the weight stuff is quite carefully managed. Your characters, like paper doll, displays pretty clearly what you've got, so other players can look at you and see if you're likely to be heavily equipped, which is obviously has a bearing on how much danger you might be in, which is good. And also when you know getting stuff out of bags and using them and manipulating them, it's not physics-y or anything, it's all really quite straightforward, but there's a sort of cumbersome put the backpack down to root through it thing that sort of bogs you down in a way that actually rummaging through a bag does. It means that sort of inventory foo is not like a skill in that game, really.
Yeah.
Stopping somewhere safe to like get a can opener out and work your way out through a tin of beans is something you've got to consider the time for, which it's a way of using the inventory system to reinforce the fantasy, which in most games isn't the case. Like, you know, no character in an RPG ever really openly acknowledges how much they're carrying at any given time in any way. Like, it is completely secondary to the story of Diablo that you play as someone magic pockets.
Yeah.
Only something like Monkey Island makes an active joke of the fact that you carry all this stuff around. So yeah, I think for me it's such an abstract thing that sort of assumed is necessary or is, you know, should be part of the way a character works in a game, that is sort of persistently a bit too abstract for my liking, I think.
One of the best things that happened to inventory systems in games forever is the Torchlight dog. Honestly, like, it's like you were saying, Tom, actually, so you just sell stuff on the spot. You've got a little pet who follows you around in Torchlight and you could feed them magic fish to change what the pet looks like. But more importantly, you can press a button to send them to sell your junk in town for you, which is both hilarious and incredibly good for the reward loop of that game. Because when you're plunging down deeper and deeper into this dungeon, you want to keep going. You don't necessarily want to keep going back up to the tower, like, the whole going back to town to do some admin reward loop is kind of old fashioned and probably should be challenged. And Torchlight's dog is one of the best, most elegant ways of just letting the player keep having fun. And also they lose a little bit of attack speed and kind of attack damage because their pet's not with them. So there's a slight sacrifice to it.
So hear me out, Tom. This is how you fix the problem with Heat Signature. You add a dog.
Yeah.
You had a little dog who has his own spaceship.
Much smaller one.
He's got a little astronaut helmet like the Jetsons dog.
Like that Russian cosmonaut dog.
Yeah.
And you feed it all the guns you want to sell. And then it runs back to your pod and ejects in its own tiny pod and returns sometime later.
It's got like, it's like a little boarding pod like yours and it's boarded yours. Like it's attached onto the side. Breached
in. Yeah. Little dog hatch opens. Yeah. You could say you could do the same thing with a drone or a robot, but that'd be wrong, Tom. That'd be incorrect. Dog. And I would score your game lower for making that decision.
Okay.
The only correct answer is the Heat Signature dog. I've now preemptively disappointed myself that that isn't the case. Ian writes, "Dear Cretaceous period and yet to be invented crowbar. The mention of Kane and Rince on your last pod prompted me to check out their latest offering on Alien Isolation. During the excellent discussion, thanks for the tip, the team discussed how you don't have to sneak past all working Joes in the game, only the ones with red eyes, a fact that many people, including me, didn't realise on their first playthrough. It made me think of the comedy sneaking I embarked on playing Thief 3 many years ago. In an open world section, early on, I sneaked inside, I thought, a Hammerite church and spent the next 10 minutes carefully avoiding Hammerites and depriving them of their belongings. Then, when perched atop a beam, I misjudged a jump and promptly fell some 15 feet to the floor below, directly in front of a Hammerite guard. Terrified, I made ready to fight him, only to be greeted with a weary, "What are you doing, Taffer?" And the guard slowly walked away. It turns out the whole area was open territory and I was free to be there. I felt quite silly. My question is, have you ever engaged in prolonged stealth, only to subsequently realize it was totally unnecessary? Thanks for reading, everybody. Ian.
I have. It was a surprisingly similar story to that. In Deus Ex Human Revolution, I was trying to sneak into the... I can't remember what the name of the gang is, but there's a gang area you got to get into. And I'd, like, taken the high route, and I'd snuck in through some apartments and some fire escapes and stuff, and I got onto a roof, and I wanted to, like, jump down off the roof with my Icarus landing system, but they'd all see me. So I wanted to, like, throw something off the roof to, like, distract them and then jump down behind them. And so I went down to one of the apartments and got out, like, a vending machine, which is enormous, and used my strength org to, like, carry it all the way up the stairs onto the roof. And then, like, hurled it off the roof as far as I could and jumped off at the same time. And the thing crashed to the ground. And no one looked at it at all. And then they all looked at me landing in my giant golden glow. And then when I landed, they're like, "Hey, what's up, man?" I just, like, walked away. Okay, fine.
In Mankind Divided, do you get a less ostentatious way of falling off things? Or
No, it's still a giant golden glow.
It's great.
I think... I can't remember how they sold in the Human Revolution, but they seem to have some kind of problem where, like, they can't always display the full animation. So sometimes, even if you fell really, really far, you just sort of land as if you've fallen from a short height without any fanfare. And, like, that only happens if you have the Icarus landing system. You can still fall, you still die from that fall. But if they don't have time to do the fancy animation, you just do, like, the no fuss, like, "I'm okay" animation.
You say there's no fanfare. That's because there literally is... probably a fanfare with the Icarus landing system, the angelic light, the choir of angels. I don't think I have a sneaking when I didn't need to story necessarily.
No, only games where crouching, old games where crouching used to be faster. Crouch walking was faster than regular walking, in which case, you know, everywhere is sneaky time.
Mm.
Playing Shadow Warrior, the new Shadow Warrior 2 recently. And you could just hammer shift to do your boost dash for no penalty. And that's way faster than walking. So I'll just, like, hop around, zoom around locations using that.
Actually, Morrowind, it wasn't so much unnecessary, but I would sneak all the time to try and steal from the shops. Yeah, partly for that. But also in a shop, you want to, like, see if you can take any of the... Most of the merchandise is just on shelves. And so you could just physically take it if the person wasn't looking. But to find out whether you... could do it unseen. You had to go into sneak mode to find out if you're being watched. Mm. And also it's better to be in sneak mode anyway to kind of make yourself less conspicuous. So I had a lot of situations where I'm, like, in sneak mode, creeping up to the shopkeeper from behind, like, trying to get closer and closer to his merchandise until it's in grabbing range. And then they just turn around and look at you and you just, like, straighten up and kind of go about your business. Oh, hello.
That is a good example, actually. The old fashioned Elder Scrolls games, the way they leveled you up, in Oblivion, I think. Particularly, doing the things made you better at the thing. Mm. So if you just sneaked around everywhere to no ill consequence, you'd get really, really good at sneaking. Likewise, jumping, just topping off everywhere.
Yeah. And swimming. Yeah. I think I have this a lot accidentally in real life, but it's a separate set of problems. Mm. I walk very quietly, apparently, I found since I started living with somebody.
Interesting.
Naturally appear in rooms and stuff. It's kind of weird knowing that that's a skill I'll never have to use in real life.
No, I scare my girlfriend all the time, even though we live in quite a small flat. I think that's just
accidental.
Yeah, we'll just walk into the room to do something and then turn around and say, like,
You have the same problem I do of being totally silent without realizing it. Yeah.
I do, actually. I've played too many stealth games, evidently. Somehow I've gained
I think it's some sort of missed, like, level up point earlier in my life. I got that one, like, silent footsteps perk that no one ever really gets.
And, are you both crouch walking around the house?
No, yes, of course.
I don't know what it is, but it's strange that it's happening to both of us. I thought that was just a me thing, because, I have to, you know, knock quite loudly and shout when I'm...
I do that now, yeah. I make a noise when I go into a room, like, or hello.
And that doesn't scare her.
Just so anyone's going to be alone.
Through a vending machine.
I'm here.
Play too much Deus Ex, maybe that's
yeah, exactly. Weird. Yeah. What a strange problem to have.
If you both wear like little bells, like
actually, you joke. Pippa suggested exactly that. Like the third or fourth time this happened, it was like getting you a little bell.
This is at least like a sizable house with lots of rooms in. Like we used to live in a flat with just three very quite small rooms, and still, like, you must expect that if you're living with one of the three, the chances of the other person being around you is quite high.
Yeah, yeah.
Nonetheless,
but you know. So, I guess some, you know, some men, as they get into their late 20s, early 30s, some men are just affected by silence. Like, yeah. You know, just how it happens. Maybe we should raise awareness of it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Exactly. Well, how old were you when you realized that you'd become completely silent? Duncan writes, what game that you've played for less than 50 hours has had the biggest impact on your life? Interesting question. Very interesting question.
I think it's partly difficult one to answer for us because when we like things, we replay them a lot.
Yeah, definitely like the big games like Deus Ex and Half-Life 2 and like obviously stuff like Skyrim, you just play for more than 50 hours if you play it through once.
Yeah.
But then there's the stuff that is shorter, I tend to replay a lot. Like, the phrasing the question makes it sound like it's got to be something that changed your life, and most games, even the games I love, did not really change my life, but I think the closest I come to that is being inspired by them. So, obviously, Portal is a brilliant lesson in, like, both puzzle design and writing, and also how to merge those two things. I guess, probably, actually, Monkey Island 2. Can't have spent more than 50 hours on that. And that was a big, like, a definitely inspired the kind of writing that I like and that I try and do. And World of Goo, I think, really like changed my concept of like how good levels can be. Like levels aren't just more content. They can be completely themed worlds with their own, you know, motifs and, fiction and, can be like their mechanics can sort of tell a story. And that was an amazing piece of design.
Mm. I'd say something like Psychonauts, and particularly games around the era that I played back then, that if I were to replay now, I'd probably become very disillusioned with. So I could preserve their how wonderful and imaginative they were in memory, rather than actually play them for 50 hours and get sick of them.
For me, I think there are... I admit that I just checked. I looked at the question and had a look at my Steam stats, because... So there's two answers to this for me. One is there are indie games from about 3 or 4 years ago, like there are experiences that like I got really attached to and that I rated very highly and that, you know, introduced me to other people who rated them very highly and sort of like played into the sort of the stuff I was interested in aesthetically at that time. And the two games that spring to mind are Super Hexagon and Hotline Miami, which were sort of an era for me. Associated with a particular time and place and group of people and so on. And I surprised myself. I thought I was obsessed with Super Hexagon, but I played 6 hours of it. And I suspect that 6 hours of Super Hexagon is like, it's like dog years or something. Like, yeah. It's, you know, there's, you know, more time passed outside than passed inside that game. Or the other way around. And Super Hexagon, and sorry, Hotline Miami, I think I only played about 12 hours, but it's not a long game. And ultimately, I guess there's not a huge amount to it, but the sort of the aesthetic has stuck with me, only marginally spoiled by the failings of its sequel. The other one that surprised me, even though it's on an edge case because it's 36 hours, is Blade Symphony, which is a game I got deep, deep, deep into and got obsessed with climbing the ladder and probably the only game I'll ever be in the top 100 for, or have been in the top 100 for.
Mm.
And that 36 hours, compared to other competitive games, like that went mega quickly, I guess.
Yeah.
Actually, Darwinia probably spent less than 50 hours on. And that was, you know, in my experience, the first truly great indie game. Like, I remember telling everyone how good it was, and they're like, yeah, but is it good for an indie game or is it actually good? I'm like, no, it's actually good. Like, it's better than other strategy games.
Really enjoyed Frozen Synapse. And only as a purely competitive thing, but I got exactly the pleasure I think I could have gotten out of it in the space of about 5-6 hours, probably. Look forward to the second one.
Yeah, it's gonna be great.
Yeah, really excited.
An interesting question, though, because I always think about the big impactful games as being like measured in hundreds of hours.
Yeah, especially now I increasingly value shorter games that are complete experiences. Like, I'd love to play, like Bulletstorm springs to mind as one, a campaign that I never need to play again, but that was just 8 hours of really fun shooting with crazy guns, and I increasingly value that, actually. It's just a really good self-contained piece of entertainment.
I have to say, I think I'm also going to, like, my habit of replaying things I love is probably going to be diminished in future. Like, I don't think I'm going to play Deus Ex Mankind Divided again. Played it through once, whereas the first one I played through, like, 5 times or something. And more, there's just so much to play that I just... if I like something, I'm not going to replay it. I'm just going to move on. And if I don't like something, I'm going to, like... I played about 4 different games yesterday for, like, 10 minutes each. I just fired it up. Like, no, don't like the combat, quit forever. Or, no, don't like the way this art style clashes with this other part of it. I'm not going to play it. Becoming incredibly impatient.
I'm more interested now in spending, like, lots of time over a short game rather than just playing through a large game really briskly. So, for example, I really bounced Fallout 4. I tried to get back into it again recently.
Yeah.
And really just, there was nothing new there for me. And, like, it's not say it's that's the fault of the game. It's more my experiences of the games that are kind of inured me to it. But for Dishonored 2, I'm going to go through that game so slowly and just admire everything. And I increasingly prefer the shorter experience that I can kind of really immerse myself in and invest in, really.
I guess I'm pretty sure to play Dishonored 2 twice because it's two different characters,
right? Yeah. I've really torn about who to play in Dishonored 2. I've no idea.
For me, it's got to be Emily first.
I think it has to be Emily first.
Feels like it should be, but I love Blink. It's one of my favourite FPS abilities ever. And it's so well done and Dishonored.
Her, like, tentacle thing is pretty similar and functionally, right?
Yeah.
Can get the same places.
It can go further than Blink. It actually goes further, but it's slower, so you'd be seen.
Yeah.
So that's the trade-off. I think having just finished a playthrough of Dishonored, talked about that last week, but, sort of playing through Dishonored 1 again, knowing what the shape of Dishonored 2 is, it made it feel like, oh, the Emily half is the other half of this.
Right.
Like, there's something about, like, seeing Emily in Dishonored, like, the very first bit of Dishonored 1, where it gives you what is basically the stealth tutorial where you play hide and seek with Emily. Yeah. And there's that reference to, like, you know, she really wants to play because this is what she does with Corvo. Like, there's a way of looking back at that sequence as, like, almost a little prequel to Dishonored 2, which should be the Emily game. Like, that's the way it sort of feels to me. Like, obviously, it could be the Corvo game as well, but that now feels like a series with 3 distinct leads where it goes Corvo, Dowd, Emily to me. I don't know if that's any one way of seeing it, but.
Which other games should you be able to afterwards replay as the main character's dad?
Or the main character's child?
Yeah, but I'm thinking if you play Emily first, then it's like, if it's Emily's game, then you replay it with Emily's dad.
Bioshock.
Andrew Ryan armed only the golf club.
Yeah. Beating yourself up.
I want to play the Andrew Ryan, like, theme hospital style build Rapture game.
Rapture Tycoon.
Rapture Tycoon, absolutely.
Or the Andrew Ryan golfing simulator. Just Andrew Ryan world tour putting.
Bio cart. Oh dear, there's that great tweet someone's seen that the Birmingham, like, Hippodrome Christmas panto this year is Dick Whittington starring Andrew Ryan, who must be an actor. But
brilliant.
Yeah. So good. I think it was Sam in the office who said, you know, it wasn't impossible to put this on in the Birmingham Hippodrome. It was impossible to put it on anywhere else. Little plug for the Birmingham Hippodrome production of Dick Whittington there. Inherently funny figures from serious video games there. Andrew Ryan.
Bioshock fits the sub-50-hour important game rule, actually.
I definitely played it for sub-50 hours. Yeah, and it was important to me, I suppose.
Yeah,
really. Actually, Metro 2033 would be another one.
Oh, that's a good call. Yeah.
Literally that game got me my career in game journalism. That was the thing I wrote about that got me working for Edge. So without that, that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So I can say it meaningfully affected my life, because if I hadn't been inspired to wank off about it in a blog post, I never would have been paid to wank off about things in magazines.
God. Mine, in in that context, mine would be The Void.
Oh, wow. The weird Russian color collect 'em up, look at boobs
game. Yeah, that's right. Which I foolishly used as my, reviewed as my, job application to PC Gamer. And, didn't get hired off that. Rich McCormick got hired off that, drive. And then I came on as freelance based on that somehow.
My sample review when I applied to be a writer at PC Gamer was Hitman 2. But I definitely spent more than 50 hours on that game. Mm-hmm. And also I didn't get the job either. Tim Edwards got that job.
Oh, right.
And then I got the discounted job later.
No one seems to get the first job, do they?
Apparently not.
No.
They could make you work for it, don't they?
Yeah.
I never even applied for a job.
That's the worst.
Interesting. What are we doing? Questions. Kyle writes, given that Daddy Pig from popular kids TV show Peppa Pig is voiced by the Dungeon Keeper narrator, would you rather have a Dungeon Keeper themed Peppa Pig episode or a Peppa Pig themed Dungeon Keeper game?
I think the Dungeon Keeper themed Peppa Pig episode would be good. They'd like learn a lesson, have some laughs along the way. It would all work out right.
I think I would go with that one as well, because ultimately, like, a Peppa Pig themed Dungeon Keeper game would probably just be like an awful iOS bait disaster, right? Yeah. Like, it would just be Farmville, but with children's characters.
I think they would Peppa, and her brother, I can't remember his name, would run the dungeon, and like Daddy Pig would have to play the hero and come in, and they'd like beat him up in non-serious ways.
A machine for Daddy Pig. <Very good. laughs> They would call it.
Do you hover above your imps and slap them with oven mitts and
yeah,
cutesy threats? Excellent. Well, the answer was obvious, wasn't it? I think even all listeners will have identified that as the better one. It's worth, that was worth reading out, because I had no idea that was the same voice actor.
That's an amazing
bit of trivia.
I always get that with Adventure Time, with Jake the dog being Marcus Fenix.
Of course, yeah.
And Bender.
Mm. Like, Bender I can see more, though, because there's an irreverent humour to both of them, whereas, like, Marcus Fenix is the biggest, like, disconnect between...
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I spent quite a lot of time with that character, more than 50 hours in that series. And, that's a real difference.
I heard the new one is good.
Gears of
War 4.
They're all good. Yeah, apart from Judgment, really. But, I mean, they're all good. They're good. They're just derivative now.
Yeah.
There's a really steady, positive escalation for each of those games up to the third one. And then after that, they're like, we can do this now. Mm. But no, they're good games.
Solid good games.
Don't know why more games haven't nicked Active Reload as an idea. Such a good idea. Where you, when you reload, a little bar starts to fill up with a timing window, basically, almost like a rhythm action game, like a beat on it. And if you hit reload again as the bar goes past the beat, you reload instantly. So you shave time off your reload, but also you gain like a certain part of that gun's clip, but does more damage.
Mm.
It doesn't make any sense, but
you reloaded this so well.
But the kind of like the correct beat to hit is in a different place for different guns, which gives different guns different characteristics. And it changes the animations and stuff as well. But for some guns, it's genuinely strategically important in a way that raises the skill ceiling. So with the shotgun, when you reload it, you can either do the kind of the manual, like plug the shells in, shoot the guy, or you can do it. It's really quick for the shotgun. You have to be really on your toes to do it. And then they do that kind of like cool, like flip the shotgun around in their hands and they reload. Yeah, the Terminator thing.
Awesome.
And then it does more damage on like, and it's only like a one shot or two shot thing. So that one damage is massive.
Mm.
And so you can either like plug away at somebody and then manually reload, or you can like do the Terminator flip and then just blow someone away in one shot. Like, it's such a cool mechanic.
Yeah.
Why hasn't that been, given how inspirational that series was, why hasn't that been nicked by literally everybody?
No, like pressing A to slam your dude into a wall has become the,
That's how video games are controlled now. Everything
does that.
Forza Horizon, that works that way. Civ, that works that way.
Slam Gandhi into a mountain.
Yeah, exactly.
I really enjoyed Gears because it was a good 40k game. Honestly, like they'd taken so much of what 40k was like and was about, and actually realised a very similar fantasy, but in a way that was actually really satisfying and chunky and, you know.
What if exciting. Mutants and big men and chainsaws in the Vatican?
Exactly.
40k.
Yeah, it really is a good 40k game.
Yeah.
It's the best 40k game.
Actually, so weirdly you should say that. That was a thought I had, and this is stupid, from Battlefield 1 as well. Because it's about like war horror and like war-torn battlefields with like death everywhere and horse people everywhere. Yeah, yeah. But these big, chunky, oily war machines.
Mm.
It really, and maybe this is just because like I learned
Warhammer takes from that.
Like Warhammer 40K. Takes 40K takes something. Like the design of tanks in 40K is way more based on World War One tanks than
like the Shermans are just in 40K, and even the Dreadnoughts, they have a kind of retro-futuristic feel to them, as they've just been hammered together.
Almost. But I'm thinking about, like, the Land Raiders in 40K, which are those big sort of, I don't know, there must be a word for those, like, trapezoidal World War One tanks, right, that were replaced by...
Land ships. Or,
yeah, the land ship kind of design, right? And so it's dumb that this is where my mind went as the game was trying to tell me about real history, but I was like, wow, that's, you know... And actually, you know, that sort of, like, ultra-violence as well, I always feel more at home with when it's dudes with big shoulders...
Yeah, and I mean, the Imperial Guard are just like a World War II faction in 40K, that just directly take from like arms Russian designs.
Yeah,
that's why they suck so much.
They don't fare well, but you know, they're there.
Yeah. How did we get on that from Peppa Pig?
That was interesting. Yeah.
We can do one train of thought all the way from Peppa Pig to the grim darkness of the far future.
The whiskey is working.
Yeah. Finally, Ellivision writes, I'm hyped as anything about Civ 6 and can't wait to get binge playing it, but why am I still not over Alpha Centauri?
Because Civilization has been kind of the same forever, and there was only one Alpha Centauri, and they nailed a different tone and a different fantasy so well that becomes this sort of inimitable, great individual product. It was hard for a series to fight that.
In Alpha Centauri, is it really clear what's going on from, like, looking at the map or, you know, just the general game view? Do you have to, like, click on cities to find out important things?
Largely, yes, I think. Yeah. It didn't have, like, Civ 5's UI, where you could just look at a city and kind of know what was going on with it.
That's because I got, like, weirdly excited about Civ 6, like... 2 weeks ago, I was just kind of like, when is that out? I quite fancy playing that. And then I ended up, the only thing I could do if I can't play it, which is to watch someone else play it. And it was Christopher Odd, who I've talked about on this podcast before, really good, YouTuber who does Let's Plays, who plays everything very patiently and very, calmly. And so it's a really good fit for Civ because it's also like, as soon as I started watching it, I was watching it on my downstairs TV, which is really big, and seeing like Civ 6 on a 40-inch screen at like the video is really good quality too, so it's like I guess it's a 1080p, it just, the art style didn't look that good in screenshots to me, but when I'm actually watching it in play, it looks really beautiful. And it's also like clean and crisp and simple at first, I got really like excited about it and like couldn't wait to play it, and also binge watched Christopher Odd playing it. And then his campaign, you know, starts off simple and he has an early war that goes really well. And then after that, it just kind of like gets more and more complicated and slower for each turn and more complex. And like looking at the screen now, I just can't tell what the fuck is going on. There's a load of icons and I can tell like those icons are roughly his color. So they're probably his things, but I can't tell what they are or what they're doing. Partly probably not helped by the fact that I'm not the person playing it, but also I can't remember like what's in any of his cities or anything, and you can only find that out by clicking on things. Technically, you can see that there are buildings, like the city spit out into the map more now, so if you knew what all the buildings look like, you could tell. But I just can't. It's just a mess. It's like a visual clutter is extreme. And I remembered, oh yeah, this is why I eventually stopped playing Civ each time. I get really excited by the early game, and then by the late game, it just gets so bogged down in fiddliness and gets so slow to play that it's a lot less interesting.
It's a perennial 4X problem, though. Like, victory conditions are a serious problem in that genre. Like, it's so rare that you get that cathartic finish or even an interesting finish. So for a military victory, for example, two-thirds of the way through the game, you've achieved that.
Yeah.
Then you have to move things around in a very boring way for the final third to actually accomplish it. And it's really the same. The alternatives are just like scientific victories or diplomatic victories, which are so abstract on this game board that they don't feel interesting either. Like the victory conditions are just are not good in 4X games still. Even for stuff like Endless Legend, which has been the most exciting introduction to 4X for decades, you know. I think things with Alpha Centauri was that there was actually a weird kind of plot to it. Like you'd get an evolving plot to the planet that would change as you were on it, and you'd learn more about it and what it, that it was important, it had a consciousness, et cetera, et cetera. And that did at least give you something to be interested in that final third, even though it did not solve any of the problems with 4-8's games in terms of victory conditions. So, the fantasy was much stronger as well, I think, than the historical fantasy. I don't know.
I'm still working on my, well, not working on it actively, but I'm still thinking about my hobby project. When the sci-fi Civ came out, I played it and didn't really like it, and was disappointed that they hadn't changed much of the formula. And so I started spending the time I would have spent playing that, making my own version of it, in Unity. But, my thing was real time. And also I only got as far as like drag selecting a bunch of units and then telling them to go somewhere and having them sort themselves into like a rank, which is really satisfying, like, if you select, because I've made a thing where it just spawns units endlessly in your home orb. There are no cities, you just have like a sphere, and units spawn there, limitlessly. And so once there's like, it's like 1 a second or something, and then once there's, you know, hundreds of them, drag selecting them all in this messy clump and then telling them to go just anywhere, they form this perfectly regimented grid, and it's very satisfying. And that's all I've made so far. But I'm pretty close to
Make your own victory conditions.
Yeah. Victory conditions, build 200 people.
Stand in a big square.
Put them in a square. Yeah.
We've done it, guys. The issue is really that, like, civilization as a concept doesn't have a victory condition. Like, yeah. That's the issue with that. You say you make a game about anything else. You know what the victory condition of a war is, or a game of football, or a race. But you can't really tell someone what, okay, yeah, what, how do you win at being a people?
Yeah, and with Civ, it's like tending a garden, isn't it? You just sort of like click on little bits and upgrade them gradually, and the whole thing gradually flourishes, and that's a deeply satisfying thing. But it's a thing that doesn't have an end.
I wonder if they should focus on that, because like, rather than trying to make it end quickly and more satisfyingly, they could just admit that it's never going to end and then make sure that it's just still nice to play, even when the map is all the places are taken for cities. And, you know, I remember someone, was it Civ, where they played like a sort of ridiculously long game and they ended up with a terrible nuclear war
game,
and nearly all of the world was wiped out.
Yeah.
That's not quite like tending a garden, but like,
end result of all gardens.
If actually like getting through a turn was relatively quick and pleasurable to do, I wouldn't mind the odd period where nothing much happened, things were stable for like a few years, and then some upsetting event happens and one faction gets some, you know, develops the nuke and suddenly has huge amounts of power. Like, Galactic Civilizations has random events that have huge galaxy-wide effects, and who they benefit is kind of random, but as a result of mechanics. So, like, there's one that's just a galaxy-wide fertility spree where suddenly everyone's population growth goes up massively. And so if you already have quite good population growth, you are going to race ahead of everyone else. And there's one where, like, a disease infects everyone in the galaxy, and so if you are good at science, you'll probably be the first person to research the cure. And when you have the cure to the disease everyone has, suddenly you can trade that for huge amounts of money and get ahead that way. So I'd love it if it was kind of more geared towards that. Like, let everyone take all the territory, at which point it's going to be somewhat stagnant, and then have big, you know, random events kind of shift the balance.
It's interesting. Cause, like, my favorite game of the year so far, XCOM 2, is all about you trying to achieve a kind of equilibrium and a cohesive ongoing research loop between the combat phase and the kind of research phase, where those two are feeding into each other at a regular rate. So you're progressing technologically really well. And then the game just going, fuck you, here's a boss monster that's going to destroy everything and you're going to have to really deal with that. And it does that just at such a perfect regularity that it keeps the campaign. Again, even the final third kind of fades a little bit, but you know, for more than most strategy games, I found it keeps that really exciting and keeps you on edge and on the verge of like having to fight for survival.
Yeah.
Whereas as a civilization, that never seems to happen beyond the exploration phase. Like, you spread out for territory, but where's the actual threat and where's the actual competition and why is that interesting? I don't know.
It's more of an aesthetic thing. And on that basis, it probably needs to be judged rather than scored. It's almost like, more like gymnastics or synchronized swimming or something. Like, you should have like a panel of people that hold a little sign. Like, when you get to the, you know, it's who can make the prettiest civilization by the time you get to the year 2100 or something, and everyone like decides, like the Great British Bake Off.
Basically. Mel and Sue come in and poor Hollywood's there. very, very. So oh, I love this Greek architecture. It's lovely.
The showcase challenge this week is make a functioning Pantheon. Democracy. It's like, oh shit, you know, you thought it was going fine, but then, I don't know, nuclear war based on religious differences or something. Oh, fuck.
The technical challenge is to fix the economy with only a rough guide to economic principles.
Exactly. Yeah.
I always wish in Civ that there was some sort of personality to your civilization that was outside of your own. I mean, thinking of Dwarf Fortress, like your little dudes create their own art and kind of record the history that's happening around them. And that would be such an amazing thing to have in Civ. Like if your citizens and the art they were creating, the monuments they were building were based on the things you kind of put them through in your attempt to
get power. I talked before about like when I played the Gods and Kings expansion, I think, for Civ 5. It also added archaeology and archaeology, like where the relics were actually are the sites of battles that happened earlier. And so I had a really aggressive early game where I stomped loads of people.
Oh, yeah.
And then I had a passive late game where I invested in archaeology and then sent out archaeologists to the sites of all the battles that I caused and had them bring back relics of those and put them in museums, which was kind of nice.
It'd be nice if, because I mean, I guess Endless Legend does that by having you play literally different factions and different races have very different personalities to each other.
Yeah, and that works a lot. Like, I'm really motivated to like, I just want to see how this race plays.
That's really cool, yeah.
I think the issue is like a lot of like Civ for all its like different, it is by necessity kind of blandly cosmopolitan when it comes to, and maybe cosmopolitan is the wrong word. It's homogenous in a way that sort of you can mix and match, you know, national backgrounds, you know, races and religions and so on. And you can do all of those things, but that has no sort of, it doesn't communicate what that would be like to live in or what that those places would subsequently like, you know, what does America that adopts, you know, the Islamic faith and then becomes a diplomatic cultural utopia look like? Like, you can sort of start to try to figure out what that, like, you know, the sort of artistic caliphate of Abraham Lincoln looks like, but you can't necessarily sort of, it'll tell you those things, but it doesn't show you them. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. Like, it turns these things into sort of game pieces that shuffle around a board without much consequence.
Yeah, it's very board gamey. And also, I feel like, going back to that question, like Alpha Centauri, it allowed its leaders to be very extreme and even extremist in many ways that made their differences exciting. So like the Hive faction was this monstrous, like super industrial faction that would nerve staple its citizens using technology to, you know, suppress things. And it's the full kind of, they were incredibly productive because they were allowed to treat their citizens in this way. And like, you can't just pin that style on an existing country or culture without making a terrible political statement about what that is.
Yeah, it becomes wildly racist.
Yes.
That's why you need space people.
Exactly. And that gives you the you know, the requisite gap to actually examine the really fascinating kind of political variance that exists across the world today.
Mm.
It's just you can't call, you know, if you had to attach that to a real life nation, then you just can't do that.
So, not would you, like, yeah. I mean, I think Civ is trapped by its, really by its, true, yeah, yeah, like.
Civ's trapped in so many ways, not only in that way, like, it has to be boring because it can't say anything exciting about Britain, or the British Empire.
Britain can be good at ships.
Yeah.
But it
can't say anything more about cultural appropriation or, like, cultural destruction and stuff.
Because obviously the game doesn't want to make the argument that certain national backgrounds are more prone to certain modes of engagement with the world than any other, but
they kind of do that a bit with Civ 6, because each civilization has agendas, and there'll be one that's random and secret, but every nation or every civ has a sort of a national agenda. So the Norwegians want to raid coastal towns, and they always will. That's Civ saying that, not
even
me.
When they enter their wonderful 21st century like digital economy and they also really want to sack Newcastle.
Yep.
They're also, that series is also really restrained by its own fan base in a way that a lot of actually kind of hardcore strategy games are. And if you deviate too far from the formula, people think it's not Civ anymore.
Yeah, I always want them to simplify, and I think that's why they never will, is because their fans would be furious.
I mean, it's interesting. Civ 5 made loads and loads of effort, put loads of effort into making it a more accessible game. Like, I love the differences between Civ 4 and Civ 5. They're both great, great games, but they both have different kind of mission statements. I feel like Civ 5 is the one, like, look, you can give this to your dad and he'll be able to sit down and enjoy it. And whereas Civ 4 was like the perfection of the Civ 2 idea, where here is the perfect evolved version of Civ 2. And I don't know what Civ 6 is going to be yet, if it's going to be its own thing or some sort of version of Civ 5. Can't wait to play it.
Yeah, it's still really exciting. It's just Civ's got loads of curious problems.
Yeah.
That's all of the questions we've got time for. If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode, you can do so by emailing questions at crateandcrowbar.com. You can also tweet us at crateandcrowbar, and you can discuss this episode and many other things on our Discord channel. The link is on the website and in the show notes for this episode, which are also on the website. If you would like to tweet us individually, you may do that. I'm at C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
I am at Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
I'm at PCG Ludo, which is L-U-D-O.
Thanks for listening, everybody.